50 women are working and being trained, has provided a place for women to learn making different handicrafts. These women are producing stunning artifacts, despite the problems they stumble upon.
We produce traditional clothing such as leather purses and shoes, hats, carpets and traditional dresses. We used to earn a living previously, but now our sales have decreased and most families face economic problems as a result.
Fereshta Hashemi, the woman who launched this place, says more and more women are showing interest in private workshops because restrictions imposed by the Taliban has deprived them from social activities.
Previously, the schools and universities were open to women, but now, as a result of the restrictions on women, girls cannot go to school and female teachers have lost their job, which is why they show interest in learning a profession so they could work in the future and earn a living.
Lida, one of the trainees in this workshop, was a teacher when the Taliban banned women from education and women teachers lost their jobs. She says maybe in the future this profession helps her earn a living.
Previously, I was a teacher and I lost my job. I wanted to learn a profession, so I came here. I am learning leather crafting now and hope to run my workshop someday to earn a living.
When the Taliban took control of the country in 2021, they banned women from education and gradually from most of the jobs in the country. Even most female-dominated professions like women's hairdressing salons were closed a week ago. Women in Afghanistan are taking refuge in small businesses not only to provide for their families, but also to get relieved from the mental pressure of being restricted from education and the other jobs they used to do. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
From Vermont to Texas, desperately needed coronavirus-era social programs are ending in the United States. On August 1st, many areas ended their moratoriums on debt to landlords, meaning nearly a million children are now at risk of eviction in the city of Los Angeles alone. Families have the highest risk of losing their home, while half of those saying they expect to be evicted are Black or Latino. Evictions in the United States have recently soared to reach double what they were before the pandemic.
Lost our jobs because of the pandemic. Lost everything we had because of the pandemic. We found a place to live with a buddy in Cheyenne, Wyoming, but he died, and that was in March. And so we decided to come out here because we thought there would be more opportunities. We're just hoping to get jobs and get into a place to live, and get a car and function. And that, so far, we've been struck out. As you can see, we're packing our bags. We're going back to Colorado.
America's decentralized model of federalism makes a nationwide approach to the evictions wave impossible. Public camping is illegal in many places, like Texas, which makes it harder for charity workers to find and help the homeless.
I had a stroke, and I was bleeding on the brain, and, you know, I had to go to rehab a lot to learn how to walk and talk again and all that. I've only been homeless like a year and a half. I went to Cornerstone Shelter, Sarah Circle Shelter, and now I'm in a tent. But I got a caseworker, I went to church, and the Cornerstone supervisor told me I popped up on her computer and I got, you know, she's got housing for me.
Other vital social services are also being withdrawn. Millions of Americans, including children and new mothers, just lost their medical coverage for the first time in 3 years after Washington refused to extend the pandemic-era program. College tuition debt represents an incredible 7% of U.S. GDP. In October, 41 million Americans will have to start repaying an average of $400 per month, and many say this alone could push the country into a recession. A lack of affordable housing is something that any committed government can easily fix. By writing laws which favor tenants instead of rich landlords, by putting more tax revenue into building more public housing, and by creating more shelters for those with emergency needs. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago. We'll be right back.
the Arab woman who took on two far-right activists in a bid to save a Quran from desecration in Denmark has been identified. Iraqi-Danish citizen Quds al-Samarai risked her own life while en route to visit a friend on Monday, the 24th of July. The footage of the incident, which occurred outside Iraq's embassy, went viral on social media. The video clearly shows Quds grabbing the Quran before being wrestled to the ground by the two men. In one instance, one of the desecrators can be seen with his hands reaching for her neck. Police later arrested Quds on accusations she was stealing the Quran from the activists. Quds explained how the incident left her with minor injuries, but no regrets.
Here the police dragged me, and the man was shouting that I stole his property. I think he was scared because he knew hitting me was wrong, so he had to justify it by saying I stole. As soon as the police heard the word stealing, they immediately put me in handcuffs and gave him back the Quran. The police asked me what happened. I said I saw our Quran being burned, and I just wanted to put it out. And then I saw another Quran with shoes on it, and I wanted to take the shoe off. But I didn't realize that the shoe was nailed on the Quran. I told the police they hit me and strangled me, but they replied with, it's their freedom of speech. So I replied, okay, so it's also my freedom of speech to protect the Quran. I thought the police came to help me, but they turned out to twist the story by saying I was trying to steal.
Quds now faces a day in court, while her injuries have left her struggling to walk. Meanwhile, Muslims across the world remain in a state of anger as calls for serious action and retaliation to Europe's defense of far-right hate speech continues.
Despite Copenhagen officially condemning the incident which occurred just where we stand outside Iraq's embassy a few days ago, that doesn't mean that they've outlawed the practice. And according to reports, several other similar incidents have already occurred since, with far-right activists again targeting the diplomatic buildings of Muslim-majority nations here in the Danish capital. However, this has come at a price. Denmark's defense of the so-called free speech of far-right activists to attack Islam's holy sanctities has led to both Denmark and Sweden's reputation to plummet across the Muslim world. Questions should surely be asked now whether it is indeed within the diplomatic interests of European countries to defend such a fringe extremist practice when, of course, there is so much at stake with economic backlashes from the Muslim world. Robert Carter, Copenhagen.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian welcomed his Syrian counterpart Faisal al-Mehdad in Tehran on Monday. The visit is aimed at boosting bilateral ties at various regional and international levels. It follows a historic trip by the Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi to the Arab state back in May.
One of our common priorities is to follow up on the agreements between the presidents of the two countries during the recent visit of Dr. Raisi to Damascus. In the past weeks, with the efforts of the ambassadors of the two countries, we have seen progress in the implementation of economic, commercial, and technological agreements between the two countries.
The two diplomats also explored avenues for advancing commercial and economic collaboration. Both Tehran and Damascus are actively pursuing de-dollarization in their trade transactions, aiming to reduce reliance on the greenback.
We've agreed that business transactions between Iran and Syria will be done with the national currency of the two countries.
Countering destabilizing elements in the region, notably the Zionist regime, was another line of discussion. The Syrian foreign minister emphasized the destructive impact of the Israeli regime, reflecting the side's joint commitment to addressing such challenges.
What we are witnessing today in the Zionist entity and regime, the depth of the crisis, that it is an illegitimate regime. Its main objective is occupation and the building of settlements at the expense of lands of others. The indigenous people of this land, the land of Palestine, or the people of Palestine.
During their bilateral dialogue, the focus also centered on the contentious issue of the illegal U.S. military presence in Syria, widely perceived as a primary catalyst for regional terrorism. Iran and Syria are two long-time allies whose joint record in the fight against terrorism in the region has been significant at the global level. The relations between the two countries can be improved to an important level by removing economic and commercial obstacles. Farzana Shiryun, Tehran.
The EU's own agencies say 96.5 million people in the bloc are at risk of poverty. Those struggling to pay their mortgages have been given more bad news. The European Central Bank has raised interest rates for the ninth consecutive time, and a tenth increase in September is not being ruled out.
The options are on the table: to continue to hike or to hold. And we also know that it will vary meeting by meeting because we want to be determined by the data.
Fuel and electricity providers are making record profits in the EU. That's good for government tax collection, but it doesn't tell the full story. For example, on paper, the Republic of Ireland has one of the best performing economies in the Eurozone. Latest official data shows in that country a record 12,500 people, including thousands of children, are homeless. Sanctions against Russia and financial support for Ukraine are factors that continue to place enormous strain on the EU's economy. Many citizens point the finger at Washington.
What the United States decides, Europe has to follow, unfortunately. And I don't think it's the best solution to keep sending weapons.
War costs a lot. I think many, many industries are earning a lot of money thanks to the war.
We've raised these issues with the EU's executive arm, the European Commission.
We can send billions of euro to Ukraine, but is there a coordinated response in terms of the social justice problems and the cost of living crisis in the EU?
At least 15 million people, including at least 5 million children, should be lifted out of poverty by 2030. And all member states have presented their national targets to contribute to this joint ambition.
But critics of EU foreign policy suggest citizens will continue to pay a big price for many years to come. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Multipolar world and invasive security were the main headlines of the talks that Russian President Vladimir Putin held with African leaders. Other issues were also discussed in the summit, including the food security. Withdrawal from the grain deal with Ukraine will allow Russia to accelerate the research of relations with African states. The food issue is exactly what the authorities can cling on to restore the ties lost after the collapse of the USSR. Representatives of African countries see Russia as a reliable partner, and thanks to this, Moscow has a good chance to firmly gain a foothold on the continent again. Putin has repeatedly stressed that Russia is ready to work together, hand in hand with African friends, to work for the future, to build a truly strategic interaction and partnership.
In the coming months, in the next 3 to 4 months, we will be ready to provide Burkina Faso, Zimbabwe, Mali, Somalia, the Central African Republic, Eritrea, with 50,000 tons of grain and fertilizer free of charge, and we will also provide free delivery of these products to consumers.
Moscow has once again written off $23 billion as part of African debt relief, implementing energy projects in 30 African countries, and is ready to settle accounts with African countries in national currencies. The descendants of prominent African leaders announced the creation of the Pan-African Anti-Colonial Legacy Forum. Among them are the descendants of Nelson Mandela, Gamal Abdel Nasser, Ahmed Ben Bella, Julius Nyerere, Samora Machel. New branches of Russian universities will be opened in Africa together with the enrollment increase of African students in Russian universities.
Russia has delayed its return to Africa. We should have done this earlier, especially since Moscow has such a good heritage in Africa. In Soviet times, Moscow has always supported liberation movements in Africa, supported humanitarian and economically. The USSR built a lot in Africa, developed a huge number of projects. After the USSR collapsed, Russia was deceived in its choice of a pro-Western vector. The result is the expansion of NATO countries by the borders. Moscow is once again resuming its relations with Africa countries when the Grand Deal is completed and African countries again nations help.
The Russia-Africa summit was attended by representatives of those countries and presented the majority of the African.
With Russia's strong return, opportunity to completely get rid of Western colonial and also now tap into their natural resources and benefit from Russian experience in various fields such as security, agriculture and energy to fuel the growth of their countries. Марина Картунова, Moscow.
In the limelight.
In California, United States, efforts to combat homelessness in the city of Los Angeles, such as housing placements and temporary shelters, have not kept pace with the rising number of people becoming homeless due to high rents and insufficient incomes. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. According to data from the US government's annual count released on Thursday, 29th of June, the unhoused population of Los Angeles has grown by 9%, with more than 75,000 people now experiencing homelessness across the county. The Los Angeles Homeless Service Authority reports suggest that there was a sharper increase in homelessness this year compared to last year, when the agency estimated a 4% rise in the population. The agency count includes people living on the street and people living in shelters. While the overall population saw a 9% increase, there was a sharper increase in people considered unsheltered, defined as those living outside in tents, cars, RVs and other makeshift encampments. The unsheltered population increased by 14% from 2022 to 2023, with more than 50,156 people living outside, making up 70% of the overall homeless population. The number of homeless people living indoors in shelters has remained steady at roughly 20,000 people. The counts are a rough estimate gathered between 24th and 26th of January of this year, and the numbers have previously been found to be an undercount. The data comes amid an escalating humanitarian catastrophe in the most populous county in America, which has prompted scrutiny from the United Nations and where an average of 6 unhoused people are now dying each day. Overdoses have been driving the sharp increase in fatalities of people living outside, along with heart disease, traffic accidents, homicides, hypothermia, and heat exhaustion. The count found the crisis has disproportionately affected black residents of Los Angeles, who make up 7.6% of the overall Los Angeles County population, but 31.7% of unhoused people. The Los Angeles Homeless Service Authority also counted 2,151 youth living outside. Within the city of Los Angeles, the Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority reported a 10% increase in the total homeless population to 46,260 people. That group included 32,680 people counted living outside, a group that saw a 15% jump. The Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority also found that 30% of the total unhoused population reported having substance use disorders, and 25% said they had serious mental illness. The website of Reddit has also covered the same story and tells us more. The largest study of California's unhoused population in decades, released recently, found that nearly half of homeless adults in the state are over the age of 50, with black residents significantly overrepresented. Research from the University of California at San Francisco also revealed that 90% of the unhoused population had housing in the state before they experienced homelessness, with 75% of them remaining in the same county. The findings debunk the persistent false claim that unhoused people mostly come from out of state and made clear that the high cost of housing was a primary cause of the crisis. U.S. officials said on Thursday, 29th of June, that the City of Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority count had similar findings that the majority of unhoused people in Los Angeles are from California. The mayor of Los Angeles, Karen Bass, said at a press conference, "It's a popular myth in the city that people are coming from far away. They come here for our weather, and they come here because we're lax in terms of our laws." She added, "That's simply not true." Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass has focused on clearing encampments and getting people into shelter, with her office claiming that her so-called Inside Safe initiative has moved 1,300 people indoors from street camps in the first 6 months of her administration. Her initiative, which launched after this year's count, has faced some obstacles, including difficulties getting people into permanent housing, lack of adequate services, and unhoused residents raising concerns about the tight restrictions and poor conditions of temporary placements. Overall, her office claimed 14,000 unhoused people had entered temporary or permanent housing this year, noting that COVID-era relief had ended, making people more vulnerable to losing housing benefit. Karen Bass said, "We also have to figure out how to prevent people from falling into homelessness." Bass added, "I'm worried that next year the count might be even larger." The Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority officials claimed on Thursday that there had been a nearly 40% increase in placements into shelters, and that the county had reduced the time it takes to get people off the streets into temporary housing programs, from roughly 110 days in 2021 to 61 days for adults. According to the Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority, the city and county are also on track to create roughly 8,200 affordable housing units this year. But Valeria Adams Keller, LASA's CEO, said, "People continue to lose housing at a faster rate than those living on the streets when moving indoors." She said, "The primary cause of homelessness are economic. Our brothers and sisters who are unhoused are struggling with poverty and homelessness because the rent is just too darn high." Los Angeles Times has also covered the same story. Public policy and common perception have long tied the road to homelessness with mental illness and drug addiction. But a new study out recently, the largest and most comprehensive investigation of California's homeless population in decades, found another cause is propelling much of the crisis on U.S. streets: the precarious poverty of the working poor, especially black and brown seniors. Dr. Margot Kuschel said, "These are old people losing housing." She's the lead investigator on the study from University of California at San Francisco's Benioff Homelessness and Housing Initiative, done at the request of state health officials. Dr. Margot Kuschel said, they basically were ticking along very poor. And sometime after the age of 50, something happened. As Dr. Kushal puts it, that something, divorce, a loved one dying, an illness, even a cutback in hours of their job, sparked a downward spiral and their lives just blew up. Dr. Margot Kushal and her team found that nearly half of single adults living in Los Angeles streets are over the age of 50, and 7% of all homeless adults, single or in families, are over the age of 65. And 41% of those older, single Californians had never been homeless, not one day in their lives before the age of 50. She said, as much as we want to see the average homeless person as a drug tourist dropping into two progressive cities for the good fentanyl and lax laws, and it's the narrative in San Francisco, or someone whose mental illness makes it impossible for them to live unaided, the truth is simpler and much more devastating. As Californians age, they're being priced out of housing. Dr. Margot Kushal added, we have come to the point of income inequality that if you are old and unable to work, homelessness is a real threat through the Golden State. For every 100 extremely low-income people in California, defined as making less than 30% of area median income, there are only 24 units of affordable housing available. Thus, as the new study puts it, that makes obtaining and keeping permanent housing an ugly game of musical chairs.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump is indicted on four counts in the 2020 election probe. This is one of the many indictments that Trump has resumed. As customary with Trump, he has said that this is a witch hunt and believes that law enforcement authorities are actually corrupt, calling them thugs, even calling them radical monsters. Well, in this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at whether the third time is the charm, the impact this will have on Trump's supporters, and weigh his chances to the incumbent Joe Biden when it comes to the 2024 presidential election.
For the first time, America is set to put on trial a former president in one of the most consequential criminal cases in the country's legal history. Ex-President Donald Trump has faced criminal charges for a third time in 4 months.
Today, an indictment was unsealed, charging Donald J. Trump with conspiring to defraud the United States, conspiring to disenfranchise voters, and conspiring and attempting to obstruct an official proceeding.
The indictment pertains to Trump's efforts to overturn his 2020 election defeat to incumbent President Joe Biden. It focuses on his actions in the two-month period between his loss to Biden and the infamous riot in Washington, D.C. During this period, Trump vehemently denied the election results, repeatedly asserting that the votes had been stolen.
All of us here today do not want to see our election victory stolen by emboldened radical left Democrats, which is what they're doing, and stolen by the fake news media. That's what they've done and what they're doing. We will never give up. We will never concede. It doesn't happen. You don't concede when there's theft involved.
According to the indictment, Trump knowingly propagated false fraud claims and exerted pressure on state and federal officials, including Vice President Mike Pence, to manipulate the election results. When failed, Trump directed his supporters to stop certifying Biden's win. That turned into a violent attack on the U.S. Capitol, leading to five deaths, a move that is described as an attack on America's democracy.
The attack on our nation's capital on January 6, 2021, was an unprecedented assault on the seat of American democracy.
Trump vehemently dismisses the case as ridiculous and maintains his innocence, refuting any allegations of wrongdoing. He even goes further to accuse the prosecutors of being politically motivated, claiming they are acting on behalf of Biden to meddle in the forthcoming presidential elections, in which Trump and Biden could face off again. The two are currently tied in polls. The Trump campaign has also asserted that the Tuesday indictment amounts to election interference. Nonetheless, this is not the only obstacle standing in the way of Trump's return to presidency. The Republican politician has already been charged in two other cases, mishandling classified files and falsifying business records to cover up a hush money payment to an adult film actress, the charges that have significantly hit the former president's reputation among many Americans.
I hope he goes to prison for a long time. I think he deserves to go to prison for all the crimes he committed.
Donald Trump is now due to appear in a Washington, D.C. court on Thursday. He faces 78 criminal counts overall. These charges mean the ex-president will have three criminal trials to attend in the next 12 to 18 months, complicating his second run for the White House.
Well, let's bring in our guests to see what they think about this. Let me introduce them. Robert Petillo, Democratic strategist, joins us from Atlanta. Also joining us is Larry Johnson. He's a former CIA analyst who joins us from Bradenton, Florida.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Robert, let me first start with you. I guess I want to get a reaction from you about the latest charge, four federal felony charges against them, and Jack Smith laid it out. What do you think?
Well, Jack Smith has done an impeccable job, both in this case and in the Mar-a-Lago documents case, in making sure that he lays out the charges that are strongest in order to ensure that he is able to prove them in a court of law. If you look at the witnesses that he uses as the basis for these indictments, he uses Vice President Mike Pence. He uses the chief of staff to former President Trump, Mark Meadows. He uses other Republican officials. And the charges that he has charged President Trump with will be very difficult to find any defense for, because much of it was was either on video, via audio recording, or with direct eyewitnesses. I think the president, the former president, is a very difficult situation. And going forward, it's going to be interesting to see if the Republican Party decides that maybe someone else should be their nominee who doesn't have so many legal challenges.
What do you think? Is he in a very difficult position there, Larry?
I keep wondering if maybe Mr. Patillo and the rest of the Democrats are secretly working to get Donald Trump reelected. All these charges that are being brought are increasing his popularity, not decreasing it, number one. Number two, the entire premise of these charges are bogus, and they're not going to stand up in court. The latest charge brought by Jack Smith is essentially saying that Donald Trump does not have the right to protest an election and challenge it. Really? Well, let's tell that to John Kerry. Let's tell that to other Democrats, Al Gore, if you recall. Al Gore fought it. How about Hillary Clinton? She refused to accept the results of the election. And there Mr. Patillo is in the state of Georgia. How about Stacey Abrams? Did she concede and say the election was fair? Heavens no. So this is a direct attack on the First Amendment. Donald Trump did not inspire that riot. That was a riot that was, in fact, manufactured by the Federal Bureau of Investigation with the Department of Justice. They even brought in members of the Azov Battalion from Ukraine to get into the crowd. You had FBI informants like Ray Epps who were inciting people to enter the Capitol, and then he's never arrested or charged. So the whole thing stinks to high heaven, and when all is said and done, they're trying to block Trump. Democrats have done this before to Robert McDonald, the governor of Virginia.
Okay.
Supreme Court overturned that 8-0. So, I mean, there's a long legacy of the use of lawfare against Republicans, and it's going to blow up on the Democrats.
Robert Patillo, what do you think?
This is part of the reason I fear for President Trump, but that sounds insane to almost anybody. That is the way the crazy conspiracy theory board sounds.
You don't get to deal with the facts instead of calling names.
Wait, okay, hold on.
That's the problem with Republicans.
I'm not going to sit here and be called names by this man.
Wait, if you both speak, we won't understand either of you. Okay, Larry, hold on. Let Robert Teo speak. I'll give you the floor next. Robert Teo, go ahead.
The issue is that argument does not hold up in a federal court. President Trump is charged with, in these four indictments, interference or disruption of a congressional proceeding. He is on video saying, let's walk down to the Capitol and we're going to go inside to interrupt a congressional proceeding. Nothing about the Azov Battalion, nothing about anything about Stacey Abrams in a federal court of law will have anything. They're going to ask you a question, did you send somebody, that are going to play the video, and then he gets convicted.
Larry, go ahead.
Yeah. Mr. Patillo obviously has trouble remembering what Trump actually said. He said, walk down to the Capitol to peacefully protest and to present your views. He didn't say go into the Capitol. He didn't say interrupt and try to disrupt the House of Representatives proceedings. Those are the facts. And you're inventing facts by claiming that he did otherwise.
Robert, do you have a response to that?
It's on video. We don't need to invent facts. There's no need for conjecture. This is the problem that I think the Trump people
play the videotape. Play the videotape.
That there is a place in where you leave the internet, you leave Trump rallies, and you go into this place of fact, which is the courtroom. The judge will be the trier of fact, the jury will be the trier of laws, and they're going to make a determination, do the facts in the indictment match what the evidence being produced? And you can talk about Stacey Abrams, you can talk about John Kerry, you can talk about Hillary Clinton, you can whataboutism yourself to death, but at the end of the day, he will be convicted on the charges because he's admitted on tape to the charges that he's been...
Larry, let's go with the premise of what you're saying in terms of him and the peaceful protests that he called for, which obviously didn't amount to that. But when you take a look at some of the statements that Trump makes, for example, this Trump tweet that I'm going to read to you, the far and away leading Republican candidate and the former president of the U.S. of America will be arrested on Tuesday next week. This is prior to him doing this protest. Take our nation back. You know, when he makes a statement like protest, take our nation back, his critics are going to say, you see, he has a tendency to want to promote something that is along the lines of, protesting that may
just not be a peaceful protest. I shouldn't say that, actually. But you see, the critics are going to jump at this, right? When he makes statements like that.
They're going to jump at it, and they're going to show their complete ignorance of American history. America was born in revolution. America was born with the rejection of British tyranny. And within that, there were calls for violence back then. And America was born out of that. So to pretend that now all of a sudden we're going to get a case of the vapors because Donald Trump is challenging what is clearly and demonstrably a corrupt FBI, a corrupt Department of Justice. There is clear evidence that the FBI had planted informants and activists within that crowd to incite a riot. And we have it on the videotape of showing Capitol Hill policemen escorting the so-called rioters around the Capitol, showing them one thing after another. So this is an entire bogus creation. And Trump, I think, at the end, when it gets to the Supreme Court, will triumph.
All right, so you make a statement there that I obviously need to get your reaction on, Robert, in terms of what America is built on. And if it's built on protests, violent ones, I think every country perhaps has that or somehow is tainted with that. But to base that on the acts that may be misconstrued, I should say, by Trump supporters, which culminate in violence, is that something you could base it on history or on Trump? With the way that he addresses his concerns?
That is strictly based on Trump. America is built off of not violence, it's built off an idea of freedom, an idea of liberty, an idea of personal responsibilities and rights, a government by the people, of the people, for the people, and not by monarchs and not by people who can inspire insurrections and inspire riots and inspire violence. If that was the case, Madison would have never, Adams would have never turned over power to Jefferson. Instead of having elections, we would just simply have coups and juntas every time it was time to change leadership. America is not built on that idea, and the American people will reject that conceptualization of what America is. And I think it's important for people to read the indictment against Trump, because Trump is not indicted for sending people or for starting a riot. He's not indicted for many things that the Trump defenders want to talk about. He is indicted for conspiring with individuals, people like John Eastman, people like Rudy Giuliani and others, in order to install fake electors. The fake electors showed up at the Capitol. We have eyewitnesses of the fake electors. These are not things that are about conjecture. They're not about arguments. These are simply the res ipsa loquitur. The thing speaks for itself. And I think that the Trump people are going to try to argue all the way around the barn, but never get to the facts. That's why I think President Trump will be convicted.
Larry, I see you have a reaction. Go ahead.
Fake electors? No. Under our system of government, there can be alternative electors that can be sent to Congress, and then Congress has the right to act upon them, to adjudge whether or not the election was fair. There are enormous discrepancies in key places across the country, particularly in Arizona, in Georgia, in Pennsylvania, in Michigan, and Wisconsin. There were enough issues that required an investigation that was not done. And Donald Trump has absolute right to question that. And Donald Trump didn't do anything different than Al Gore did back when Al Gore claimed the election was stolen from him by George W. Bush in 2000. So the Democrats want to have it both ways. When it's their ox getting gored, they want to scream and complain and cry. But when they want to do it to the Republicans, oh my God, it's a noble cause. It's ridiculous.
But let's look at this former Trump lawyer, Giuliani, because I think this is important. And I'd like to ask you, Robert, what you think, where he, at the time acting as Trump's lawyer, he made false statements by what we understand, asserting two Georgia election workers mishandled ballots while counting votes in Atlanta during the 2020 election. Now, he came out and he admitted to the fact that he lied about that. Isn't that significant, given the fact that what reason he would have to do that other than either him promoting that to Trump or for Trump to tell him this is what you need to do? I would think it's one or the other.
Absolutely. And this is part of why I keep saying that this is not a question of conjecture. This is not something where we have to speculate about what happened. We know for a fact that they lied about the election being stolen. They continue to lie about the election being stolen until today. President Trump has never won the popular vote in the history of time he's been in American politics. He even said before the 2016 election that if he lost, he was going to claim the election was stolen. There's a long history of this on the Republican side of the aisle, and part of the reason they don't want to simply address the facts that are laid out in this four-count indictment is that once you start looking directly at what the law is, what he is charged with, the evidence that's just publicly available, not even what's going to come out at trial, it's clear that President Trump is guilty of what he is charged with. Not to mention the fact that the cooperating witness in the case is Mike Pence, the former Vice President of the United States, will be taking the stand to testify against the former President of the United States. That's unprecedented, not just in America. Mm-hmm. That's unprecedented almost in any international courts of law. So I think the president can keep arguing whataboutism, but at the end of the day, the court and the law is very clear.
Larry, if you have a reaction to that, go ahead.
I need to correct the record on a couple of things. Number one, Giuliani did not lie about the two women in question that were mishandling the ballots in Georgia. In fact, there's video evidence of that. I've been deposed in a case involved with that. You can see over and over that they keep submitting, putting ballots through a machine when they should only be put through once, but they put them through multiple times. So there was legitimate reason for questioning what was going on in Georgia. In fact, the story in Georgia kept changing. Initially, they said they had to shut down the counting of the ballots because there was a busted water main. Oh, but then it changed. It was then a toilet. No. Then the story changed. It was a urinal. And the reality was there had been a water break at 6 a.m. on election day, but it was completed and fixed during the day. That was used as an excuse to bring to miscount the ballots. So there's actual facts behind this, not subjection, not speculation.
All right, let's move on. And I'm going to stick with you, Larry. I'm trying to understand the train of thought here by Donald Trump when he goes after the special counsel, Jack Smith. Okay, he's called him deranged, and he called him a Trump hater. Even if that's true, let's say, don't you think that that works against Trump when he's going after the guy who's trying to prosecute him? In this case, I'm going to go out on a limb and say he's not the same as Mueller. I think he's really after Trump, and it looks like he wants to gather evidence to go through and see what he can get out of it. But when he comes out and calls that, at the same time, you would think naturally, logically, he would lose maybe voters that are in between by making calling names to the special counsel here.
Well, you've got to call something what it is. You know, there was a prosecutor by the name of Roland Freisler, a judge in Nazi Germany that was notorious for screaming at the plotters who tried to kill Adolf Hitler. Do you think they were wrong in condemning him and calling him names? So I think in this case, what Donald Trump is up against with Jack Smith is a corrupt prosecutor, a man who's got many contradictions in his background, and how he has handled previous cases.
Very well. So let me get a
that's
reaction
what people
here.
Like. People like Trump taking him on directly.
Let me ask you a reaction on the same question, Robert Padillo, and reaction to our guests there in Florida.
Well, this is part of the issue that I think Republicans run into when they have to start existing in the same reality as the rest of us. Okay, let's say you disagree with Jack Smith. Well, what about Fannie Willis in Fulton County in Georgia? Those indictments are still going to come down. So then you say, well, she's corrupt too. Well, what about Alvin Bragg, the DA in New York, where they have 34 outstanding counts? Well, they're corrupt also. Well, what about the Department of Justice? The whole Department of Justice is also corrupt. What about the FBI? The whole FBI is corrupt also. What about your Vice President Mike Pence? Also corrupt. What about your Chief of Staff, Mark Meadows, also corrupt. At some point in time, they have to start living
Biden?
The same reality that we exist in. Whataboutism doesn't work. These kind of kooky ideas don't work. You have to come back to the place of just saying, what is in the indictment? What does the law say? What do the facts say? And that's what the jury will be deciding on. I think that is a disservice to the Republican Party to continue this whataboutism and kind of conspiracy theories instead of just looking at the facts and trying to find a cogent defense for that.
Well, you mentioned a number of officials there of rank. I didn't hear Joe Biden in there because Joe Biden, Larry, is also somewhat, from what we understand, been accused of corruption. I'm sure you're well aware of that. He doesn't have a clean slate, so to speak. What do you think? Do you think that he's also corrupt based on, I guess, this allegation of him accepting bribes from a Ukrainian firm?
Well, we don't have allegations. We have actual evidence and testimony from Joe Biden himself. He's before the Atlantic Council saying how he got a prosecutor that was going to investigate Burisma fired because he threatened to withhold $1 billion in aid. And the previous week, he was on a phone call with his son, who was being hired by Burisma to sit on their board with absolutely no experience either in the gas industry or with Ukraine as far as speaking the language or knowing the culture. So it was clear influence peddling. Candidly, if Donald Trump or any of his children had engaged in any of the conduct that Hunter Biden and Joe Biden have done, then they'd be in prison. And you know what? I'd support that. They should be in prison if they did what Biden's have done. But the level of corruption and the evidence of grift by Joe and Hunter Biden is off the charts. And that's why that's why the Democrats are so desperate to try to get Donald Trump on anything that does not hold up to scrutiny. You can write anything in an indictment, but ultimately when it's brought to court and then it goes through the appeal process, okay, Donald Trump will be found innocent.
Okay, you see, this is exactly why I think is a good example of the stance that Larry Johnson has there, Robert, is perhaps one of the reasons why there are many who are not into this rematch that may happen between Trump and Biden. And they want another outlet, or they want another candidate. But there isn't one. I mean, from what I understand, there's only one candidate for a third party, if I'm correct in that. What do you think about this, first of all, the fact that there are many Americans who don't want a rematch and that they want a third candidate to somehow gain traction, which usually they don't, and it just takes away from one party in terms of the numbers or the other party?
People have said that for years. It's not going to happen because of ballot access laws, because of the difficulty in fundraising. You have groups like No Labels. You have Cornel West, who's running for the Green Party nomination. We always have more than two parties running. It's just that they do not get the majority of support of the people. I think that what we have in this in our system right now, in the two-party system, is a choice. Do you want Joe Biden's record? Do you want 3.4% unemployment? Do you want 350,000 jobs being created? Do you want the defense of our allies around the world? Or do you want somebody with 78 felony indictments who's been impeached twice to be president again? It's a very clear choice. I think this is why Republicans kind of invented this Hunter Biden thing. This is why they run down all these rabbit holes, because I would love to know what the Republican health care plan. I would love to know what their plan on education is. What is their plan on national defense or to deal with homelessness? All they have is these weird conspiracy theories, and that's why they have not won the popular vote since 2004.
Let Larry answer.
Nearly 20 years.
Larry, go ahead.
Well, that's not correct. Let me just remind Robert of one. He keeps touting Mike Pence as evidence against Trump. Here's what Mike Pence said on January 4th, 2021. Quote, "I know we all got doubts about the last election. I share the concerns of millions of Americans about voting irregularities. I promise you, come this Wednesday, we will have our day in Congress. We will hear the objections. We will hear the evidence." So he wasn't sitting there going, "Oh, hey, that election was 100% good and we're all good with it. And anybody that's raising questions about it is a crazy conspiracy theory, like Robert." No, there were legitimate questions. So this notion that Joe Biden is a popular president, his numbers are at levels that are below what Donald Trump had. And he's going to wind up being more unpopular than Jimmy Carter was, who Jimmy Carter still holds the record for being the most unpopular Democrat president.
All right, very well. We're going to unfortunately have to end it there. I'm sorry. Robert Padilla, thank you for your contribution. Democratic strategist from Atlanta. Larry Johnson, a pleasure. Former CIA analyst from Bradenton, Florida. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tafoya and the team, it's goodbye.